Well, we've got the new year coming up, and some people, Christians, will decide they want to read through their Bible for the year. Most of the time, though, we read little pieces, don't we? We'll read a chapter, or in church, they'll preach on maybe just a few verses of the Bible. And I thought it might be interesting today to do something a little different, and I bet you've never heard this before, and that is to do in 30 minutes or so an overview of the whole Bible. That sounds crazy, right? So we're not going to have time to go over every verse, but what I thought might be good is if we could take a look at the Bible as far as history and culture and who's doing what and when, so that we get kind of a feel for it. Then when we plunge into a particular book of the Bible or a particular set of verses, we at least have a pretty good idea of what's going on and what's happening to the children of Israel or what's happening in the New Testament. And so if nothing else, I hope as you walk out of here today, you think about the Bible is a real book about real people doing real history. It's not a fairy tale. When I was a kid, you know, they had all those flannel boards and they would put little pictures up there, and I thought, gee, what a neat story. But I didn't get the feeling, and it took me years and years to get the feeling that these were real people. This really happened. They had dirt under their nails. They worried about invasions and wars and calamities, and they had good times as well. Yeah.
The biggest impression on me was to see on TV the Bible.
Yeah.
The extreme cruelty and children. But I think it was portrayed the way it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't a fairy tale story for sure.
No, these are not people drifting across the landscape. I mean, they had worries and they had jobs and they had broken hearts and they had successes and they were like us. God uses people like us, right? So I thought what we'd do today is go through, again, and I don't want to feel like we're rushing. We're just going to do a kind of a quick overview to get kind of a feel for the whole Bible. So I thought, well, why don't we start with what would be the setting? And so look at my first point down there. It says Fertile Crescent. So I'm curious, do enough of you have Bibles that have maps in the back? Otherwise, I'm going to have to draw something. I'm a terrible artist, so you don't want me to do that. But most Bibles will have, at the beginning of a set of maps, will have something that looks like this, which is the big picture, right? This is a big picture map. It's the whole Middle East area. And if you don't have it, you can just check it out on your own at home sometime. But if you'll notice, you've got something, most of these Bibles will have something over on the far right, which would be far east, and it'll show the Persian Gulf down here. Can you see that on yours? That's that body of water that you hear so much about with the Middle East problems that are going on. You have two rivers that flow into the Persian Gulf, and these are two of the most famous rivers in the Bible. A lot of time is spent with events that happen near those. Anybody recognize those two rivers? Yeah, the Tigris and the Euphrates. And again, we heard a lot about that when the United States was going into Iraq, right? So that's pretty well known. Now, what happens in that corridor down there, mine shows up as kind of a different color there. That's where a lot of the early civilizations started. That's called Mesopotamia, fancy word. It just means between the rivers, two rivers, right? The Tigris and the Euphrates. So we're going to look at several groups that come popping out of that area, and they become huge, and they take over that part of the world. And then they fade. They fall like some civilizations do. And then another group from that same area comes up, new group, new city, and they take over and crush everything. Well, if you follow then an arc that's kind of like an upside down U, if you notice, if you move up and start moving back down again, you come along the coast of the Mediterranean here. And if you keep following the Mediterranean on down to where it ends and then starts moving toward the left side, you've got Egypt, right? So you say, well, yeah, I knew all that. Okay, but what a lot of people don't realize is you either have the strength over here with Mesopotamia, one of those countries comes along and becomes huge and strong and powerful and dominates the region, or you have the Egyptians will have strength and it'll fade and it'll come back. And so it's not just always a power, right? These countries kind of come and go. And sometimes they're both equally strong and then they clash, they fight back and forth. And look what's in between those two. Canaan, the land of the Jews. God gives them this land, but it's a pretty tough land, isn't it? Because they've got to deal not with just making the land produce, but they've got to deal with the people over on the far right those are the Mesopotamian peoples. As they grow and get strong, they're very aggressive, and they come. And now the people that are in Canaan have to worry about them. On the other side, you've got the Egyptians, who sometimes grow stronger and get more aggressive, and they push their boundaries out. And guess what they run into? The Canaanites, or the people in the land of Canaan, whoever's there. And so I want you to think about that as we go through the Bible today, that you've got the people of Israel are sitting in a very precarious situation. Sometimes the Mesopotamian people will come along and say, are you with us or are you against us? And they have to make a quick decision. Do they say, okay, you know, we're on your side? Then they get the Egyptians upset, right? Because the Egyptians don't want the Mesopotamians coming next door. So they'll say, what? And we get this tug of war, this fighting that goes on back and forth. And in fact, eventually it's one of the causes of a fall of part of Israel, because they chose the wrong superpower, right? So we got these two superpowers. Sometimes they go by different names on one side. The other side is always Egypt. Egypt doesn't change. The other nations will have different names, and we'll come across those in a little while. So does that make sense as far as the setting of the stories all through the Bible? Okay. Well, let's start then with the books of Moses, right? I just called it the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and what's the fifth one?
Deuteronomy.
Okay, so some of you know your five books of Moses. So these first five books of Moses, obviously hugely important, because in Genesis we get introduced to the Bible's version of who God is. Is that the same kind of God that the other cultures worshipped?
No.
Have you ever read anything about these other gods? They were like teenagers, right? They were full of spite and anger, and they would argue with each other. All these different gods would, there was chaos. They couldn't control the chaos. They didn't like people in particular, and they're always striking people down. And it was a pretty crazy situation. And then we're introduced in Genesis to a very different kind of God, a God who loves people. A God who's outside of space and time, and he creates everything. That isn't what the other gods did. They were in the middle of this mess that got created. Right? They didn't create the universe. They were just part of it, and they couldn't control it at all. But we worship a God who is a controller of the universe. He brought it into existence. He shaped it. He said it's good. He said, I love people. I want to interact with people. You don't get that with these other gods. So from the very beginning, it's a different God than what anybody else around was thinking about. Very, very different. And he was only one, right? It wasn't a bunch of gods. He was the God, the one God. So we get that from the very beginning there. We get introduced to Abraham. Did you notice Abraham? Do you know his story? His story is the Fertile Crescent story. You see why they call it a crescent, by the way? I don't know if I explained that. It looks like an arc or a crescent kind of on its side. All right, so he's born, or his family comes from Ur. If you look on the map, Ur is way down close to the Persian Gulf. They move to Haran. If you look at your map, he's coming up that Fertile Crescent. And then where's the land promised? Canaan. So his life is following this Fertile Crescent life, right? He starts in the rich area where civilizations are rising. He moves further away from that, and then he moves way out in the boonies, which would be the land of Canaan. And so you can trace his life, kind of like that upside down U that we were talking about. Well, let's move along, still under Torah. Let's start coming up with some time periods. So I just gave you some brief dates. You don't need to worry about them, but just at least gives you something to hang on to, that we're really talking about history here. So something around 1400 BC, so 3400 years ago, would be the time of Moses. Now, people will argue, you know, year here, year there. So I'm just rounding them off, okay? So something around 1400 BC, Moses comes. And of course, a lot of people scratch their heads and they say, well, okay, the Bible talks about the children of Israel being in the land of Egypt, but is there any proof for it? Well, I don't have time to get into that today, but there's a resounding answer, yes. Did you know that? They found all sorts of things that were results of having Israelites in the land of Egypt. I've never heard that before until about 2 years ago, and then I came across all sorts of stuff. So there's a lot of evidence that there were children of Israel living in Egypt. There are even stories of them, and as they moved out of the Exodus and as they came into the land. So I can talk on that some other time if you want, but this is the big picture today, right? So we're just kind of moving past that. So number three, they're out of Egypt now. They're moving into the land of Canaan. Those would be the books of Joshua and Judges. As they come in and they start settling the land, they've got some problems, right? They're fighting with those people who are already there. And so one complaint that's been raised against the Bible lately is, that I've heard more than once, is that God advocated genocide. And the answer to that is no. But that's another lesson, right? So we can do that some other time. But no, it was not genocide. So in comes Joshua with his tribes. They set up the land. Do they conquer the land totally? No. There are pockets of Israelites, and there's still pockets of the non-believers in the land. So then you get the stories of the judges. And don't think of these judges like white wigs with robes, right? These would be tribal leaders. People that the individuals in that tribe would look to and say, you settle our problems. We trust you. And you know what's interesting about these tribal leaders? Did you notice in the book of Judges, one of the premier ones is a woman? Do you remember the name? Deborah. Terrific. She gets two chapters in the book of Judges. One is called the Song of Deborah. By the way, that's kind of interesting. We do that in our literature class at Palomar. We look at the story, which is in one chapter. The very next chapter is her song, and she retells the story, but she tells it in a song. And it's really kind of interesting to see how she doesn't change it, but she does in a way, right? She's doing something different. When you sing a song, it's very different than if you tell a story, isn't it? I mean, it's just the way literature work. So take a look sometime, read those back to back and see what you think when you hear the story and then you hear her song. And it's a very ancient song, obviously. So there we are. We got Joshua, we got Judges, we got these people that come along and help rule their tribes. Well, let's move along to 1 Samuel under number 4. Let's move several hundred years now. Now we're around the year 1000. And the people look around them and they see these other people who are living kind of nearby, the Philistines, for example, and they say to Samuel, who's the judge at the time, hey, we'd like a king. And it's just worth it. I've got to read this just a little short section to you. It's 1 Samuel 8. Samuel says, you want a king, huh? This is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they'll run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders. I'm going to skip a verse or two. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He'll take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He'll take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants, your men servants and maid servants, the best of your cattle and donkeys. He'll take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. Does that sound familiar at all?
Yeah.
You hear what Samuel's saying? You want big government? It'll take from you. You're going to lose, and then you're going to complain about it. Now, I don't want to really get political this morning, but does that sound familiar at all?
Really?
Yeah.
The more government gets, the less we have, right? I mean, that's what Samuel is saying here. I mean, to me, it doesn't matter if it's Democrat or Republican. The more you give to somebody else, the less you're going to have, because it requires an enormous amount of energy and resources to run big government. And those people said, that's okay, we're for that. And you know how the story goes from that point. Samuel says, okay, Saul becomes king. We're going to skip over Saul, if that's all right. Let's pick up David here. 1 and 2 Samuel. David is probably the best known character, huh, at this point of the story. Why do you think so much space is devoted to David? There were other kings, there were other judges and spiritual leaders and all, but David gets an enormous amount of space in the Bible. We learn a lot of his life. Why is he given so much space, do you think?
He's a man after God's own heart.
That's right. It says that he's a man after God's own heart. He had he made some terrible mistakes, didn't he? But he repented, and his heart was always there. Sometimes his head led him astray, but his heart was there. Why else? There are other reasons.
Well, his repentance was sincere.
Yes. Yeah, he's a model, isn't he, for how we all can make terrible mistakes and come back from that. What else? Give me some other reasons.
He was destined to be the king.
Oh, there we go. He's a king. Mm-hmm. And he's a combination. He's a king and he's a fighter. Right? He's a warrior. And that's an interesting combo, isn't it? I mean, fighting is courage, right? That's difficult stuff. But it's also a different kind of courage, a different kind of wisdom that's required of you if you're going to be a king. And to have a person to be able to combine those two is pretty difficult to get. Let me give you a couple of other reasons. How about what's going to happen? What does God promise him as far as his descendants go?
A king
forever will rule, and eventually there will come somebody someday, a son of David, right, who will be the ultimate king. And of course, Jesus then traces his lineage back. So we've got David being the predecessor for Jesus. The other thing, maybe one or two other things that he did, he united the kingdoms that were kind of arguing, some of these clans, and he established Jerusalem to be the capital city. And he bought the land or set up the land for the temple. He wasn't allowed to put the temple up, but he got it ready. So no wonder he's a really well-known person in the Bible here. Of course, we think of David and we think of the book of Psalms, don't we? But did you notice many of the Psalms either talk about things or they are credited to other people? So don't think of every Psalm in your Bible, 150 of them, they're not all David. The early ones are. Many of them are not. In fact, I'm going to read a psalm later that's not the time of David, it's later. So we're around 1000 BC. Here's the good news as far as Israel goes at this time. Remember we talked about those two superpower groups, the Mesopotamian people and the Egyptians? This was a time where neither one was very strong. And so it allowed the people in the middle, the land of Canaan, just to have trade and no warfare. And so the kingdom starts rising, right? The Jewish kingdom starts rising at this time because it's got no threat. Nobody's coming along and punching them and knocking them down. And so the kingdom rises under, in 1 Kings, under Solomon. And you see the extent of his kingdom. It's huge. If you look at a map sometime, his is a pretty good-sized kingdom. And we associate with him what's called the wisdom literature of the Bible. What two books in particular do you think? Well, there are three really, but two I wanted to focus on. What do you associate him with as far as Bible? The book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Some people scratch their head with the book of Ecclesiastes, don't they? Because it seems pretty grim. But keep in mind, he says this is the human perspective. What's the point of it all? You can be a king, you can have all the wealth you want, you can have the women, you can have the wisdom. And where does it get you? You die. Vanity, vanity. It's like a vapor, and it's gone. But that's a human perspective, right? So it's not what God says life is about. There's a bigger picture. There's a spiritual picture as well. But so that's what you get from Solomon. Well, here's the problem. Look at the next step, number five. This wonderful kingdom falls apart. There was internal dissension and disagreements for a long time. It didn't just all of a sudden snap out of nowhere. And it's almost like the American Civil War, really tragic. You have the northern 10 tribes, 10 of them, right? We have 12 total, 10 tribes split, and they form a northern group called Israel. The two southern tribes, what are they called?
Judah.
Yeah, Judah. Okay, so good. You know your history really well here. It's kind of confusing, though, isn't it, for the books there that I mentioned under 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles. You keep hearing these, so-and-so is the king of Israel, so-and-so is the king of Israel, and you may want to say, well, that's the whole land. No, it's not. That's the 10 northern tribes. And the Bible usually shows those kings as wicked. They tend to not do what God wants. Now, they probably did some nice things, but the Bible writers want to show you the contrast. The 10 northern tribes are not pictured nicely, pretty much. They keep telling you those kings are not very good. The southern kings, though, under Judah, tend to be shown more favorably. They do closer things to God's heart.
Judah and who? There had to be another.
Benjamin.
Benjamin.
Yeah, those are the two. And then all the other tribes are up north. They set up, of course, since Judah got Jerusalem, then they set up Samaria. That was the area that they worshipped at. So there's the split. Kind of sad, huh? These people all worshipped the same God, and yet they had such antagonism for each other, they just fractured, just like the north and the south did in the United States. This is a north-south split as well. Well, now we start hearing, remember I told you those kingdoms were kind of quiet on either side of Israel. Now we get some rumblings, and along comes Assyria, roughly round about number here, 700 BC, so about 2,700 years ago. Assyria comes along. They are nasty folks. No wonder Jonah says, "You want me to go to Assyria?" Remember the story of Jonah? And he heads the opposite way. Yeah, I would too, probably. I mean, I don't have enough courage. These were awfully tough people, and they were terrific fighters. So they come swooping in from the north. They've been fighting their way, accumulating empire as they go, and they come across the 10 northern tribes. They collapse, and they're taken off into captivity. Assyria was not just a defeater of nations. Once you stood up to them and they took you over, they moved you out, brought in other people so that they wrenched you out of the land. Can you imagine that? You lose your home ground. You lose what you're used to eating, where you buried your ancestors. You can't see that anymore. You can't see your city skyline. It's all gone. So these become, have you ever heard that term, the 10 lost tribes of Israel? For centuries, people have tried to trace them. Where'd they go? And you get some people who get kind of crazy about it, and they say, England. Right? England's part of the 10 lost tribes and all. Well, nobody knows. They just kind of disappear into history, right? So the 10 tribes are gone. That's about the last we hear from them. So we get some of them stayed behind. They were not all taken. And then Assyria brought in other people. And now you got this kind of, I hate to use the word mongrel mix, but you got this mix up north. And do you get the picture now why during Jesus' time the real good Jews down south didn't like the people up north, because they called them Samaritans? They were not really total Jews, and they treated them like dogs. They couldn't stand them. They would walk around their territory. They wouldn't even go up north. And so when Jesus tells the story about the good Samaritan, wow, did that open up some eyeballs. Those people are nudging each other. Did he say good Samaritan? They're all no good. And so that must have been a real eye-opener. We can't imagine today when Jesus tells a story about the good Samaritan, we say, oh, that's nice. But it'd be like us today telling a story about the good ISIS member, or the good Al-Qaeda person, or the good militant Islam, defender. You go, what? And so that story had some impact because of this history, because of what happened thanks to Assyria. Well, Assyria wasn't finished. They came on down against Hezekiah. But they couldn't defeat him. Do you know? You probably know the story. It's in the Bible. What happened to him? It's in, I mentioned a couple of books here. It's 2 Kings and Isaiah. What happens to him when they come up against Hezekiah? They actually surround Jerusalem. They set up a siege.
Well, the guy that was in charge,
Sennacherib is the king.
Well, no, his underling.
Oh, yeah.
Actually ridiculed or mocked God.
Right.
And so God took his vengeance upon them, killing 180,000.
Yeah, the angel of God just moved through that camp, the Assyrian camp, and decimated them. And so Sennacherib had to go back home. You know what's interesting today? You can go, I don't remember what museum it is, but there's a huge stone monument. You know, those kings are always so full of themselves. They used to say to their assistants, write what I did. And so they'd have all these glorious battles that the kings had won. Well, they've got the one from Sennacherib, the Assyrian. And you know what it says? It's honest. It says, I shut up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. But you know what it doesn't say? And then I defeated him. It doesn't say that, because he didn't do it. And so it's kind of interesting. You can find that today. It's been translated. And it says, I shut him up like he was a bird in a cage. Ha! But there's no other sentence down there that says, and then I took him and hauled him off. So there's actually honest discussion going on in this monument. So that I thought that was interesting. Number 7. So where are we now? We're really at the time of the prophets. What was the job of a prophet, by the way?
Well, two things. One was to to chastise the people for not being obedient, but then that the second one that they were to forecast the future.
Right. He said forecast the future and to chastise the children of Israel, because remember, they had signed an agreement, hadn't they? Not literally signed it, but they had signed a contract back at Sinai. And they said, you'll be our God and we will do what you ask us to do. So here come the prophets and they say, you're not living up to that contract. And because you're not living up to the contract, God is going to have a punishment in store for you. Get your act together. And they don't get their act together. There go the 10 tribes to the north. Those prophets now are turning their eyes to Judah and saying, same thing applies. You're not following what God asks you to do. And so all these warnings come out. You see them book after book in Isaiah and Jeremiah and so on. By the way, the prophets are split, aren't they, into major and minor prophets? Have you heard those two terms? It doesn't mean some of them are better than others. It just means there's more space devoted. What are the four major prophets?
Isaiah. Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Lamentations.
That's Jeremiah. Yeah. So give me the names of the prophets themselves, not their books. So you got Ezekiel and Isaiah, Jeremiah. Who's the last one that's considered part of the major? Daniel, right? So they're the four. Then you've got Obadiah and Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, right? You got Malachi. So you got 12 of those. Try to keep those straight. Do you ever try to find one of those in the Bible? Look up something in Haggai sometime. Good luck. But so, you know, some are only 2 and 3 chapters, and so it's a little difficult. But so you have the first four of the majors, and you have 12 of the minors. But they're all kind of doing the same thing, aren't they? They're telling the people, thus saith the Lord. That was the job of the prophet. I am here to tell you what God wants you to hear. And often these people were really abused, weren't they? The people didn't want to hear that. And they would throw them into cellars, and they would kill them, and they would abuse them immensely because they came to tell them, you're not doing what God asked you to do. All right, well, now we get another kingdom starting up. This is Babylon. Here's the good news. If this stuff makes your head spin a little bit, because we're going to do three major empires, they're alphabetical. That's good news, right?
Yeah.
It's the only way I can keep them straight, right? A, Assyria, B, Babylon. The third one's going to be not C. It's going to be way off in the alphabet, but at least it's A, B, and then it's Persia. Well, we're at B right now. We get Babylon coming along. Babylon knocks down Assyria. They take over. They're the big guys. They're the tough ones. And they come sweeping over just like Assyria did. And now they come up against what's left of Israel, just those two tribes. And they win this time. There's no helping the people. And you probably have heard the story. Nebuchadnezzar comes in and they destroy the temple. They take away all of the treasures of the temple. The people are hauled off into captivity again. And there it goes. Can you imagine as you're trudging away and you're looking back and you're seeing that temple and you heard your mom or dad talk about the glory of God that was there and you're never going to see it again. You're never going to experience that connectedness to God. It's gone forever for these people.
It's not the same thing, but it sort of is. I read something on the internet the other day that the only way that they are able to evaluate the damage to all the ancient sites of Syria is by drones, by airplanes. And they are taking aerial shots of all these places that are thousands of years old. And the Syrians are destroying them deliberately.
Oh, that's so sad.
It is. I don't think they understand what they're doing.
Right.
They're ruining their future, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just unconscionable to do something like that. Well, remember I said before that not all the Psalms are by David. Let me just read a portion of one Psalm because it's so powerful. At least I think it's powerful. It's Psalm 137. And I'm just going to read the first three verses of that. Obviously, this one's not written by David because David was writing when the kingdom was doing well. This one was written as the people are being hauled off into captivity. They're sitting there in Babylon, hearing those stories of how wonderful it was at one time. And this is what they're singing or saying. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? So there they are. The joy is gone, right? How can you sing a song about, let us go up to Jerusalem? Because Jerusalem's gone. They're not there anymore. And so they just hang the harps up. We're not singing any more songs about Zion. What a terrible thing. They had it all, and they kicked it all away. So it's gone. But we know there's something else the prophet said to them. I'm going to take you to one place because I want to share the good news about this as well. This is in Isaiah. Here we go. It's Isaiah 40. What else do the prophets do? They warn them, they chastise the people, they get on their case, they prophesy. And then they also do things like this. Chapter 40 of Isaiah, comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. So much of the prophets will say, look, God has judged you, but it's not going to be forever. There's going to be a good thing that'll come out of this eventually. It must have been hard for the people to hear, but at least there was some comfort there. And when does the comfort start? Well, let's move along to number 9. We had the A, Assyria. We had the B, the Babylonians. They fall in turn to a new group that has risen again out of Mesopotamia. This time they're called the Persians. And the Persians sweep over again, and they have a huge kingdom. It's just enormous. And they seem to be a little more enlightened when it comes to captured peoples. And so this is where the books of Ezra and Nehemiah come in. The king is actually willing, if some people want to, he's willing to allow the Jews and other captive people if they want to go back. Remember, the Assyrians and the Babylonians have pulled them away from the land. So now the king says, if you want to return, you can. You're not going to be arrested or anything. So Nehemiah goes back, Ezra goes back, and they find it just an utter devastation, don't they? And so the book of Nehemiah is actually a pretty interesting book. He has to try to rebuild with a sword on one hip and a trowel on the other, you know, because they're trying to rebuild things, but there's people there that don't want them to be there. And so it's quite a job Nehemiah has. But this is at least some of the comfort to the people. We can go back. Now, did all of them go back? No. But some of them did return, and now they're back to the land. Now here are those familiar skylines. Now here are those graves of their departed loved ones. But of course, the land has just been totally devastated, so they got a lot of work to do there. Number 10, so now we're down to around 500 BC. Let's go another 200 years. Now we're 300 BC. Somebody comes on the scene, Alexander the Great. Probably heard of him. What does he do? Well, he doesn't like the Persians. Why not? Because he's Greek. Do you know some of those stories of the Greeks fighting the Persians? Thermopylae, Salamis, Marathon, these big battles that went on for dozens of years. And so here comes Alexander, and he doesn't like the Persians at all. And the first thing he does is take his army, and he sweeps east, and he knocks down the Persians. He just conquers them, and he spreads the Greek world, Greek ideas everywhere. He goes down into Egypt, so it comes down into Egypt as well. There's a famous city in Egypt, Alexandria. Gee, where'd they get that name? He's naming cities after himself, and that wasn't the only one. He had cities all over the place. So what does that mean? Well, what's the importance of that? Well, a couple of things. One is Daniel, as one of the prophets, said a lot about Alexander and his kingdoms. It is an amazing bunch of prophecy. Have you had a chance to read through the second half of Daniel? The first half are the stories that we grew up on, the fiery furnace and the lion's den story. But the second half is prophecy. And he prophesies very clearly. He doesn't name them, but it's very clear about what Alexander's going to do and then what's going to happen to Alexander's kingdom after he dies. In fact, he is so clear that a lot of people say Daniel must have been written, these are the skeptics, Daniel must have been written after the fact, in other words, around 100 BC. Because who else could get things that accurate? Well, I'll tell you who could, God. So there are a lot of reasons to actually believe that Daniel is as old as we think it is, several hundred years before Alexander. But it's just amazing. He prophesied all this stuff about Alexander and what he was going to do. The other thing that was important about this time period is that now you've got Greek culture everywhere. The Jews think it would be a good idea to translate their Hebrew scriptures into Greek, right? Because more people would understand it, and they could spread the news of God through their scriptures. So they create something called the Septuagint. You ever heard that one? That's the Hebrew Bible turned into Greek. And this is the Bible that the New Testament writers refer to when they say, as it was written, and they'll mention Isaiah, they'll mention Jeremiah, they'll mention something, they're using the Septuagint. And so that's a big deal, right? That's a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. All right, so number 11. Now we're down to getting close to the time of Jesus. But we have that gap, don't we, between the end of the Old Testament and the coming of Jesus, something like 200 or 300 years, where there were no more Old Testament books being written. But there were some books being written that are kind of interesting. They're not on a level of Scripture like we would think of with the Old Testament. They're called the Apocrypha. You heard that? You ever seen any books of the Apocrypha? You ever had a Bible that has the Apocrypha in it?
The Catholic
Bible does.
Yeah.
Right. So again, this is the big picture day, so I won't go into details about the Apocrypha, but neither the Jews nor Jesus and his disciples ever really referred to them. So they're not considered Scripture, but they're interesting books. A couple of them are really good history books called the Maccabees. Mm-hmm. It's a story of the Jews. It's a great story, by the way. If you have a chance, read the Maccabees. It's just an amazing story. The Persians have come in, and then Alexander came in, and then his henchmen, after he dies, are running the Holy Land area, and they're terrible people, and the Jews rebel, and they successfully rebel. It's an early, like an American Revolution thing, except it's the Jews fighting off these interlopers, and it's all in the book of Maccabees, so you might enjoy that.
Is that where Hanukkah comes from?
Yeah, that's right. When they cleanse, they get their temple back, and the oil continues, you're right. So they still celebrate Hanukkah today. Two other things happened during this period between the Old Testament and the New Testament. It'd be the rise of Rome, right? Rome's the 5,000-pound gorilla, right? I mean, they took over everything, right? So Alexander's kingdom has fallen apart. Now it's Rome, and they're huge. The other thing that's going on is we start to get a rise of a different group of people that are populating the land. One is the Pharisees. They would be considered the real conservatives, right? The real Bible believers. It's scary because it's probably a little bit like us. Remember, Jesus is always going after the Pharisees, but they're the ones that treated the law with so much respect. Well, there are reasons for that we can go into some other time. The other group that during the time period is starting to rise are called the Sadducees. They're more liberal. They didn't believe, for example, in angels and afterlife and things like that, and they tried to trip Jesus up. They'd ask him questions about the afterlife to try to make it appear like a stupid idea, and of course he'd flip it on the head, and they were the ones that ended up looking pretty dumb. The third group of people that came along during this time were the Essenes, and they would be like the monks later on. They didn't want anything to do with their society. They thought everything was corrupt, and they would head out to the desert and set up little communities out there. So what's so important about the Essenes? That's where we get the Dead Sea Scrolls. So they left Jerusalem. They set up a community near the Dead Sea called Qumran. And when the Romans came through, they hid in jars. They hid all of their precious scrolls from the Old Testament. And it wasn't until 1946 or 47, some little Arab kid was just pitching rocks up there in a cave, and he heard a ka-chunk. He said, "What's that?" And then he scrambled up, and here are these jars that sat there for 2,000 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And inside, and they just had an exhibit down in San Diego not too long ago, some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the actual scrolls. They're really important, but we're moving along here, right? So you can look them up and find out more about them if you want. But that's what's going on between the periods. New Testament times come. Of course, we get our Gospels written, we get the stories of Jesus, we get the letters of Paul. Did you ever notice something, by the way, when you look at the New Testament? Why are the letters in the order they're in? Have you ever thought about that?
Well, they're...
It's not chronological.
No, there's Paul's letters to the churches, Paul's letters to the individuals, then... after that is the
Hebrews.
Hebrews, and then we have the individual letters from John and Jude.
And did you notice each one gets shorter? That's really it, right? Paul's letters go from longer to shorter, and then the people that we don't know or were not Paul, then they're all clumped together, and they go from long to short again. So it's kind of cool, right? Third John is what, like 15, 20 verses,
yeah.
And you're done. Jude's shorter yet, right? So, third John, Jude, yeah. So they're short, and then they don't know what to do with Revelation, they just kind of stick it at the end there. But Revelation is an amazing book, isn't it? I mean, but here's the deal about Revelation. Again, I'd be glad to talk to you about it sometime, but it was not an unusual book to the Jews. It is to us, but to the Jews it's called apocalyptic writing. It was a form of writing. It was very popular back then. We just don't write that way today. But it's in Zechariah, it's in Ezekiel, it's in Joel, and then it's a whole book in the New Testament called Revelation. So it's not an unusual, strange thing. It's something the Jews would have understood a lot better than we would have understood.
I was saying that when I was reading, I think it was just John, and all of a sudden it was like I was reading Revelation.
What book were you reading?
Which one was it? Before Malachi,
Zechariah.
Oh, Zechariah, yeah.
Yeah.
Zechariah. Exactly. There are certain characteristics. They have certain actors that do things. They have certain themes that come up, and it's the same in those books. Well, just two other things. I forgot. I went past it because I'm galloping along here. Something big happens in the book of Acts. You know, that's the story of the church moving out and beginning to share the message of Jesus. But there's one chapter in particular. It's Acts 16. I don't know if you remember that, but Paul has this vision. It's called the man from Macedonia. And he says, come over here and help us. Now you say, okay, that's nice. But let's do geography one more time. Paul has been ministering up and down the coast, and he's been ministering into little areas of where Turkey is today. So everything from Turkey to the right, if you think of it, to the east, all of that's considered Asia. Okay, if you take that split there between Turkey and you got the Aegean Sea and everything to the west, everything to the left is considered Europe. That's where the seat of power was, right? That's where Rome was. Rome was far more interested in that area than something way far off. So this is not just Paul going to a new city. Isn't that nice? This is Paul moving to the centers of power, right? He's heading now where major things can start happening. The Christians will now start influencing seats of power. And it isn't all that long, is it, that the Christians are doing so many good deeds. Paul writes his book of Romans. They're moving toward the Roman Empire now, the big heart of the Roman Empire. And so that's a huge thing to happen, to have Paul heading off that way instead of staying in Asia. Christianity would have been more of a regional religion instead of a worldwide religion, but he moves it over, ministers to the people of Greece, eventually Rome. Peter ends up in Rome. The church spreads there. Pretty soon the Romans see the good things that Christians are doing, and it just explodes, right? It's the whole empire starts becoming more interested in Christianity just because of that vision that Paul has and spreads the word. Well, as I said, the one thing I hope you get out of this, it was a whirlwind, I realize, but just that there were real people doing real things with real empires coming and going, and that the Bible is not a fairy tale. This is a real thing that's got dirt under its nails, right? That these are real people. So thank you very much.